Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Realty Speak, the podcast where we dive deep into the nuts and bolts of the real estate world, offering you insights, answers, and real-world stories to help you elevate your real estate investment strategy. I'm your host, Bill Widener, and today we are tackling a topic that's crucial for every investor, property owner, and tenant out there: housing court reform. In the bustling heart of the five boroughs of New York City, housing court plays a pivotal role intended to resolve disputes fairly and efficiently. But what happens when the system itself starts showing cracks? Today, we are peeling back the layers to understand the complexities of housing court. And joining me in this critical conversation from the law firm of Cucker, Marino, Winarski, and Bittens are Nativ Winarski, making his fifth appearance on Realty Speak. Craig Gambardella returns for his second discussion, and I'm thrilled to welcome Eric McCavey for his first time on the show. Together, we'll explore the intended function of housing court, how its administration has evolved, and the stark realities of its current state, and the landmark lawsuit that aims to change the current inertia to positive momentum so that all the stakeholders can experience the relief the system was intended to provide. So, without further ado, let's dive into this vital discussion as we seek to understand, challenge, and inspire change within the housing court system. This episode promises not just to enlighten, but also to empower you to engage with efforts to reform a cornerstone of New York's real estate landscape. Eric, Craig, and Nativ, thanks for being here today for me and the Realty Speak audience for episode 52 on this spring-like Sunday in the Battery Park City studio on March 3rd, 2024.
Excited to be here, Bill.
Great to be here, Bill, for discussion number two.
Bill, is this really the fifth time?
That is correct, Nativ. And I would talk about all the other episodes, but if I did that, we wouldn't have time for this one. However, I think it is crucial to reflect on a particularly significant episode, number 27, mid-March of 2020, everybody remembers that, where we discussed the consequences of the Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act of 2019, only 9 months in at the time. And what set this episode apart was not just our detailed exploration of the HSTPA's impact on multifamily real estate, but also the serendipity of its timing. Recorded on March 10, 2020, and released on the ominous Friday the 13th, we were blissfully unaware that in just 9 days, our city's landscape, along with the multifamily environment, would be irrevocably altered by the shutdown caused by the pandemic. Now, 4 years later, the HSTPA casts a longer shadow over multifamily real estate, a situation dramatically exacerbated by the pandemic. And I think that that's a perfect segue for us to start our chat about why this lawsuit against the court system of the city and state of New York, and why that actually has to happen, and why now. Let's get started. First, how about a quick overview of the firm's broad range of expertise, especially with litigation?
So Cucker, Marino, Winarski, and Bittens started around 40 years ago. Its founders came out of the predecessor agency to the DHCR, and its focus was initially on landlord-tenant litigation, primarily in housing court. We've since considerably expanded both the number of attorneys and the practice areas, so that while we still do a good amount of housing court litigation, we also do a significant amount of administrative law, specifically DHCR-related due diligence. We've also significantly expanded our commercial litigation practice, all things real estate related. So that's either state court litigation, federal court litigation, and class action litigation. So we do consider ourselves a full service real estate firm in the city.
Nativ, many people think that the purpose of housing court is to evict and displace, but that is not actually the case, is it?
No, it's not. In fact, in your intro, you said that the housing court plays a pivotal role intended to resolve disputes fairly and efficiently. And I think that's absolutely correct. That was the initial intention. The purpose of housing court is to resolve disputes between landlords and tenants. Prior to the housing court being enacted under Article 7 of the Real Property Action and Proceeding Law, in order for a landlord to resolve a housing dispute, they generally needed to commence an action in Supreme Court, which was known as an ejectment action. The problem with that was it took a considerably long period of time. Long period of time at that point was considered between 6 to 9 months. And so the legislature came up with what is known as a summary proceeding, which is the rules and procedures of a housing court under Article 7, in which initially it was intended that such proceedings be resolved within a 30-day period. And the way housing court currently functions, the expectations of resolving any disputes is certainly not within 60 days, and it's unfortunately not within even the 6 to 9 month period of ejectment actions. As it's presently being conducted, these proceedings can take a year, year and a half.
So the RPAPL, what does that mean again?
Real Property Action and Proceeding Law.
And when did that go into effect?
That was enacted in 1962.
So starting in 1962, if somebody was bringing a case against a tenant to evict them, or for whatever reason, I guess, it would have to be settled within 30 days?
It wouldn't have to be settled, but if you look at the statutory time guidelines set forth within Article 7, that was certainly its intention. And there were, in fact, cases which discussed that the cases should be resolved before the next month's rent becomes due and owing.
So was that actually happening back in the 60s and 70s?
It was, in fact, happening. And what we've seen happen since that time, as the years have gone by, is that it kept the time from which a case commenced and resolved kept getting longer and longer, and it was especially exacerbated after COVID.
Eric, how has that all evolved since the 60s, 70s, 80s, coming into the millennium, and now here we are a quarter century into that?
So I think that practitioners in front of the housing court would say that housing court has been delayed for quite a long time and veered away from efficiency instead of towards it for the last several decades. COVID and the moratorium on evictions certainly led to an enormous backlog. And I think that what we've seen now, since the moratorium being lifted and housing court getting up to a normal caseload, is that that backlog has created a ton of congestion in the civil court. And instead of doing what needs to be done in terms of staffing, in terms of abiding by certain statutory guidelines for the timing of processing these summary proceedings, we see that the court system is coming up with pretextual reasons for the delays that are plaguing summary proceedings today.
Is this the worst it's ever been in terms of timing?
I can't imagine it being any worse. When we were evaluating what cases to use as examples in our Article 78 petition, one of the first tranches, one of the first focuses of our petition is the fact that upon answering a non-pay proceeding, there is a very specific, very explicit time limitation that a trial must be set by the clerk within 3 to 8 days thereafter. Obviously, in order to illustrate how far the court has fallen from that standard, we really wanted as poignant of examples as possible. But in going through those, we actually did inquire as to whether there were any cases that actually abided by the 3 to 8 days. It was very hard to even find one case in which the statutory guideline was actually followed.
So tell me, what does Article 78 mean? Because this is an Article 78 proceeding?
Correct. Prior to the enactment of Article 78 of the CPLR, there were various writs people could pursue in court. Two of them, which we have adopted here in the, or that we pursue in this Article 78 proceeding, is mandamus and prohibition. And they really are basically two sides of the same coin. Mandamus would be that there is a non-discretionary mandatory duty by a state actor or quasi-state actor that is defined by statute that is not being abided by. Prohibition being the other side of the coin is that there is a certain prescribed jurisdiction that is set forth in statute that a state actor or quasi-state actor is acting outside of. And so what we find here in the three tranches or three thrusts of our petition is that the courts and the various other named respondents are not only not abiding by or not following these mandatory directives by statute, but in fact, they are acting outside of the jurisdiction defined in statute. And therefore, that's why it was necessary for us to both pursue mandamus and prohibition.
You mentioned the three focuses of the petition.
Yes. So certainly our petition has three, I would say, tranches or sections in which we focus on where the courts have sort of diverged from the statutory mandate. You know, obviously, it's very easy to paint with a very broad brush and say that housing court is broken, it just doesn't function efficiently. That may be true, but that's not necessarily something that you can bring to court and get a specific relief for. So when we were evaluating various potential causes for the egregious delays in housing court, what we found is that there were really three very well articulable problems in which the courts had sort of diverged from where RPAPL Article 7 really envisioned or contemplated summary proceedings to proceed. That would be in terms of non-pay proceedings. As I mentioned before, RPAPL 735 is very explicit in as much as once a tenant answers a non-pay petition, the clerk shall set a trial date between 3 and 8 days thereafter.
What's happening now?
As we spell out in our petition, the average is well over 60 days.
What are the different proceedings that somebody would bring against a tenant in housing court? I guess there's something called a holdover. Another one would be non-payment. Are those two correct? And are there others?
Those would be the ones that are contemplated under RPAPL Article 7. It would be holdover where you do no longer have a right to possess the premises, and notwithstanding that, you stay in the apartment or in the premises. And the other would be, obviously, just the non-payment of rent.
So you said once the tenant answers the petition, the court has how many days to set a trial?
After the tenant answers that petition, the court must set a trial date between 3 and 8 days thereafter.
So in other words, the trial date actually has to be between 3 and 8 days. Not that the setting of a trial date into the future.
Correct. This actually goes off of what Nativ was speaking about before. RPAPL Article 7 envisioned a very expedited procedure for landlords to be able to regain their property once it was determined that they were entitled to such possession. And so the first time on really is contemplated to be a potential trial date in either holdover or non-pay proceedings. Obviously, the purpose of any adversarial system or any adjudication in front of the courts is to resolve disputes. But if there really is no dispute, if there really is no defense, then that first trial date, that first return date really should be a trial date.
Okay, so one of the things that you said there is that the whole system is designed to resolve disputes. So the goal is not really necessarily to have the tenant evicted. It's to have the tenant either pay the rent, or if they are not entitled to remain in the property, then they become entitled to remain in the property, or they leave the property.
So if I can just answer that, Bill, landlords don't profit from an empty unit in which a tenant was evicted. Landlords and tenants profit from resolution of the claims. And so if a landlord is commencing a claim, a non-payment case in housing court, the intention is not to evict the tenant. The intention is simply to collect rent, provide certain time for the tenant to make that payment. Tenants are looking for a resolution of the arrears. Tenants are not looking to be in arrears. They want to live peacefully in the premises, knowing that the rent has been paid. If there's an issue of the tenant coming up with the money, there are certain governmental programs that can be asserted or accommodated within housing court that can assist the tenant. The purpose of resolving these disputes within housing court is not eviction, but as you said, resolving disputes fairly and efficiently. And what's happened here, and it goes back to your question of what was the intention and what's been done now, what's happened here in terms of the three groups that were commenced in this complaint, you have an issue of the proceedings are intended to be put on the calendar within a very finite period of time. And as Eric said, what's happening now is it doesn't generally get on the calendar for the first time between 60 and 90 days. You're supposed to have a trial date within 3 to 8 days after a tenant answers. We're not seeing trial dates for 9 months if you're lucky. And in terms of the warrants are to be issued upon the entry of a judgment. And that doesn't happen as well. That oftentimes takes months. And the clerks are setting certain conditions before those warrants can take effect. So in all three key facets of the housing court proceeding, you're seeing delays that are wholly outside the scope and strictures of the statute, compounding month after month after month, such that the arrears are completely exacerbated by virtue of the fact that instead of a tenant being in arrears for 3, 6, 9,000, tenants are sometimes in arrears 25,000, 50,000, and now tenants are unable to make those payments, and the housing court system thus has completely broken down.
The defendants in this case are the state of New York and the city of New York, correct?
That's correct.
What was the impetus for the plaintiffs to start this petition? And why are they doing it now? Why haven't they done it in the past? Because this seems like it's been a problem for a while. I guess the question I'm asking is, how did this all come about now, today?
The straw that broke the camel's back was most likely the timing after COVID, where there were stays put into place.
The stay, that was the eviction moratorium, correct?
Correct. And a significant backlog of cases that were commenced pre-COVID, coupled with the retirement or never returning to the courthouse by clerks, court officers, judges, and court attorneys. So the backlog plus the current cases that were being commenced after the stays were lifted in housing court completely overwhelmed the system, such that, for lack of a better word, justice was not being served for either landlords and tenants. As we were filing this lawsuit, I spoke to numerous people that told me that tenants who had all the best intentions to pay their rent after being sued for non-payment couldn't pay their rent after being sued, not because they didn't have or couldn't come up with the money that they were being sued for, but the delays that were caused during the housing court process exacerbated the arrears to such a high level that they couldn't afford the arrears that after the case was completed, accrued.
Well, I guess when you have an 8-ounce glass, you can only put 8 ounces of water in it. And if you put 16 ounces of water in it, it's going to overflow. So that's the overwhelm that you're talking about. Is that really the city and the state's fault?
Can't imagine who else would be at fault for it. Some of the respondents in here are specifically tasked, whether it be by the New York State Constitution or by New York State law, on administering procedure that's going to serve the people of the state and the city of New York. And what we spell out in the petition is that the time periods have become so egregiously delayed, so egregiously far from what was envisioned by the legislature. And it's very important to understand that the origins of summary proceedings is 1820. So it's not as if that this was merely the attempt to expedite procedure from the 1960s. This is over 200 years of legislation. They certainly have modified it based upon the changing relationship between tenants and landlords. And notwithstanding that, notwithstanding 200 years of history, we have fallen so far away from what the legislature intended, so much so that, and we spell this out in the petition, that the current state of summary proceedings really is a mirror of the common law ejectment proceedings, which they were designed to replace.
And if I can just add something to that, to who's to blame, I think it's important to note that we don't want to in any way give the impression that you have this backlog due to housing court judges being in any way lazy or not getting to their calendar or anything to that extent. Housing court judges are probably the hardest working judges in the city. But it is a function of the Office of Court Administration not properly administering the housing court, whether providing personnel, budgets, or otherwise. It is up to the Office of Court Administration to run the court system as envisioned by the legislature. And as envisioned by the legislature, the statutory time frames is very specific, and it has been completely abrogated by its current functioning.
So when I listen to the three of you tell me about all of this, and I think about the case itself, what comes to mind is that this is a mess. And is there a way out of this mess? And is the petition part of that solution?
I mean, certainly that's the hope. When it comes to the petition, when it comes to how it's laid out in terms of the relief that we seek, we really follow the really the life cycle of the eviction proceeding, whether it be from the petition to the actual adjournments in the interim. And then finally, and kind of the most egregious, would be the issuance of warrants. Really, as we've spoken about before, it's the setting of the trial dates that's just certainly not being done. And then in the interim, where landlords and tenants are supposed to be appearing on these return dates, and if someone has a justification for an adjournment, sometimes, at least in the first instance, for a tenant to obtain counsel, that's supposed to be heard by a judge. Someone's supposed to make a formal application. And very importantly, whoever it makes that application for an adjournment, it's supposed to be attributed thereto. And that actually triggers a certain protection of both parties, really, in the statutory framework of RPA PL 7, which is certainly abrogated by the fact that these adjournments are giving out administratively, without any application being made by a party, and no attribution is being made to either party. But certainly the last tranche of our petition really spells out kind of the most unexplainable egregious falling away from what the statute envisioned, which is that RPAPL 749 specifically states that upon the granting of a judgment of possession, which is that a landlord has now proven to a court that it is entitled to repossession of their apartment, the statute envisions that upon that granting, that a warrant shall issue, a warrant of eviction shall issue, and landlords are inexplicably waiting 4, 5, 6 months. This is not a matter of the calendaring of cases. This is not a matter of the court system being overwhelmed with cases. This is a matter has been basically resolved. The dispute has been adjudicated, and for some reason, landlords are left holding the bag for 4 or 5 months without being able to repossess the apartment.
What causes that?
The delay itself, I think, is the universal problem. And certainly there are these instances in which, perhaps pretextually, because they certainly can't get to the eviction, judges, clerks will come up with ancillary conditions in order to reject a requisition for a warrant. So thereafter, the time basically starts over. Because if you're waiting 4 or 5 months for a warrant, you know, that's somewhat more explained if it's already been rejected once.
So you get the judgment, which entitles you to a warrant, which would entitle you to actually regain possession. And if an eviction with a sheriff within means to do that, that's what that would be. And that whole process after you get the judgment is lasting 4 or 5 months. What's the reason for it lasting 4 or 5 months? Is because according to RPAPL, isn't it that supposed to happen with a certain time frame?
There are two reasons for this. The first reason, I believe, is that clerks are incredibly overwhelmed. As Nateef said, housing court judges are the hardest working judges in New York City. Housing court clerks are the hardest working clerks in New York City. Clerks are overwhelmed. Clerks can't get to the issuance of warrants as fast maybe as they would like, number one. Number two, judges and clerks are putting conditions on the issuance of warrants where under law, no conditions exist, whether it's requiring additional filings, requiring additional explanations, or requiring something else that is not required under law. They put the onus, or they attempt to put the onus back on the landlord to have their warrants issued after judgment where no requirements exist, but the landlord, in order to get the warrant, scrambles to meet these requirements because otherwise they will never receive issuance of the warrant thereafter.
They'll never get the warrant issued, as you said, and regain possession of the property.
That's correct.
We've talked about what all the challenges are, and we certainly have agreed that it's exacerbated by the pandemic, and it doesn't follow the statutory framework that is intended. So now this case happens. What does this case do next? And maybe give me some examples of some cases that you researched, because you said you couldn't even find one that followed the statutory requirements.
First, let me deal with the first part of your question, which is that what could be the solution? Because obviously this is, and we make clear in the petition, this petition is not brought as an academic exercise. This is actually to get relief for not only our client, but really most similarly situated landowners in the city. And what I anticipate being the defenses to our claims is that clerks, judges, the system itself is overwhelmed, perhaps underfunded, understaffed. And that really lies at the doorstep of the Office of Court Administration and the Chief Administrator. If the housing court cannot function as is mandated by RPAPL Article 7, as has been envisioned by the legislature in passing and amending RPAPL Article 7, and if they're not getting the funding that they need, if they're not getting the help that they need, then perhaps this lawsuit, if it results in a compulsion that the court system must abide by RPAPL Article 7, that I don't think that there's going to be a choice but to staff the housing court appropriately, fund the housing court appropriately, because, obviously the housing court is made up of people. They can only handle so much, especially in terms of the backlog from COVID. And I think that maybe someone has fallen down in not supporting the civil court, not supporting the housing court to deal with what was very obviously going to be an avalanche of evictions after the moratorium was lifted.
And if I can just further that point, it needs to be emphasized that this is not a petition seeking to reform housing court. This is not a policy complaint. What we're looking to do is to revert it to its original intention. And we're asking the court to ensure that the housing court follow its mandate. And if there wants to be a discussion about how housing court has some of the dates should be modified to a certain extent, or whether there needs to be a budgetary process to ensure the proper functioning of housing court, those could all be discussions had within the legislature. And I think it'll be a good thing. So the center of attention will be on housing court and how it could properly function, with everyone acknowledging that as the system is functioning now, it is a broken system, which is to the detriment of all parties walking through the door of the court system.
If housing court operates as it should, what positive effect does this have on the tenants?
As has been said, the concept of housing court was to ensure that the resolution of rent arrears occurred within 1 month of the timing of rent, right? So if you were sued on the second, hypothetically, the case would theoretically, or it was envisioned that the case would be resolved by the end of that month. So you had a box and you had a finite amount of money in that box, and the case regarding that money would be resolved at the end of that month. So that box would be cleared out by the end of the month. That benefited tenants because tenants knew how much they were exposed to. They could figure out with their property owner how to pay that money off, and then they would be free to live their lives peacefully in their apartment as envisioned by their lease.
And it should also be noted that when you have a tenant who owes 12 months of rent, and now the arrears are $25,000, $30,000, $40,000, tenant is not necessarily able at that point to, if they wanted to apply for what's known as a one-shot deal where the government assists in paying some of those arrears, because those arrears have accumulated such that they are now tens of thousands of dollars. Government may only be able to pay through the one-shot deal or through other assistance programs half of that money. And so now the tenants are in a situation where they're not able to get the government to assist them in the payment of arrears. They don't have those arrears. And now, as opposed to being in a position where the issues could have been resolved, now the tenant is facing an eviction, which is what everyone sought to avoid in the first instance. And so you have that issue. And you also have the broader perspective of if landlords know that they can't get resolution in these housing cases. I don't need to tell everyone here or the listening audience what is going on in the current environment, especially after HESPA in 2019. I don't need to tell everyone how landlords are suffering because they can't put improvements into the buildings, get their money back, what's going on with the interest rates. And you top all of that with landlords knowing that if they start a non-payment proceeding, they're going to have to wait 12, 14, 16 months to recover their arrears. Landlords simply can't operate the building at that point. And when you have a situation where landlords, in addition to everything else going on in this environment, are not able to recoup arrears and thereby not having the monies to operate their building, well, then tenants suffer as well because they can't get an apartment in which the improvements are being made, the repairs are being made, perhaps the heating is not turning on as consistently as it used to. So again, all of the parties concerned, landlords, tenants, the citizens of New York, are all suffering due to the breakdown of the system.
Quick little break here, Realty Speak fans, to take a moment to share with you that I love that you choose to listen and learn from Realty Speak. And now, with that in mind, I'd like to share that in addition to my mission to be the best real estate advisor, consultant, and broker I can be while helping you sell, purchase, and finance investment real estate, I will also help you comply with New York City Local Law 152. That's LL 152, periodic inspection of gas piping systems. This law applies to every building, gas or not, that is not a one-family or two-family residential dwelling. That's every apartment building from three units and up, every condominium and co-op building, every hotel, every industrial building, every freestanding retail building, and more. Yes, every building except one family and two family residential dwellings. It's been around since 2020, and so has my company, Keep My Gas. Learn more about the law and how to comply at www.ll152.nyc. That's www.ll152.nyc. Or I'm just a phone call away, 917-232-8529, 917-232-8529. I'll explain everything, get you a quote, so if you haven't complied yet, you can do so before it's too late. What else can I say? Solutions for real estate, it's in my DNA. And now back to the show.
I can envision people that are not practicing in the real estate industry, and someone that might be listening to this program might question that summary proceedings have been around for 200 years. Perhaps there hasn't been systemic delays like there are now. Why didn't the legislature contemplate that there could be languishing or delayed summary proceedings and put in some sort of protective mechanism for both tenants and landlords? Because as we've talked about, it really is the egregious delay or the very long delay of summary proceedings of 9 months, 12 months, 16 months that allows these arrears to get to such an extent that at the end of the proceeding, a tenant is faced with a very large amount of arrears that they're able to make good on it. There actually is a protective device in the RPAPL, so Article 7, that has been defeated by the specific delays highlighted in our petition. RPAPL 745-2, and not to get too much into the weeds of this, but it actually states that upon a certain amount of time after the first court date, a landlord can make an application to the court for a deposit of what's known as use and occupancy with the court. So what it would do is it would require a tenant to deposit the amount of money that is allegedly owed and continue to make those payments into court. Because obviously, the very practical aspect of a non-pay proceeding is that many times tenants have a very legitimate reason why they haven't paid their full amount of rent. And so the housing court has acknowledged that. But in order to prevent a very large amount of arrears to become due from a specific tenant at the very end of the proceeding, RPAPL 745-2 has that being deposited into court so that the landlord is confident that there is money to collect to collect against in the court, and the tenant isn't stuck with this very large amount of arrears that they sort of have to come up with at the conclusion of this proceeding. However, as we spoke about, 732 is not being followed, and therefore, that first court date, in which the time period for that application for use and occupancy can be made, isn't happening for 60, 70 days. And thereafter, these adjournments are being granted, and they're not being attributed to a tenant or a landlord. So that actually prevents the time period, the 60-day time period, from running. And so what winds up happening is that protective device, that specifically crafted protective device in the RPAPL to Article 7, is sort of eviscerated. Because it never comes to a point, a productive point, for a landlord to actually make that application that would prevent this huge amount of arrears that winds up being this ultimate harm to tenants from coming to pass.
I kind of understand that. And I think I just want to ask a couple of questions about it, if
sure.
you don't mind. So what you're saying is that under normal circumstances, a tenant didn't pay their rent on the first of the month, when it was due. And the property owner files a non-payment case against them. And after they do that, and the case is live, so to speak, the court can collect money from the tenant and put it in some kind of an account? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Well, the court can order use and occupancy being deposited into court.
Oh, so in other words, use and occupancy is the person still living there.
Correct.
Right. And that's what that means.
Yes. We're talking about non-pay proceedings very specifically.
Right. So they're basically saying to the tenant, the court's saying to the tenant, hey, you didn't pay the rent, but you're still living there. And so you need to pay for the use and occupancy of the property while this is going on. And then, depending on what the resolution is, that money will go to the property owner.
Correct, because that mechanism, the court having to adjudicate that application and order or not order that deposit of use and occupancy, is really allowing the tenant the time to show their defenses, show why the landlord isn't entitled to X amount of rent. And that money is not necessarily going to the landlord, but the landlord knows it's there. And the court will ultimately decide how much of that money goes back to the tenant and how much that money goes to the landlord.
And did that happen often? Well, in other words, when it was happening, was it happening often?
It happened often. One of the issues as to why it's not happening any longer is something that we haven't really touched on yet today. Let's touch on it. The city council enacted the right to counsel program for tenants in housing court. The right to counsel program enables any tenant who is under a certain income level to obtain free legal counsel during their housing court proceeding, whether it's a holdover or a non-payment proceeding. What has been happening in housing court is any case, irrespective of the income of a tenant that is brought in housing court, is administratively adjourned on the first appearance of that housing court case for legal service providers, legal aid, NYLAG, to conduct an intake between the first time the housing court case appears in court and the second time that a judge administratively adjourns to, in order for the legal service provider to make a determination as to whether or not the tenant is entitled to free legal services. What Eric was talking about is this administrative adjournment is not attributable to either the tenant or the property owner, which is a abrogation of law, because each adjournment, unless it's on consent, must be attributable to either a property owner or tenant. By not making this adjournment attributable to either party under that RPAPL's time mechanism, doesn't trigger. So therefore, the judge can't order a tenant to deposit that money into court for another, if the administrative adjournment is 30 days or 60 days, it can't order that tenant to deposit that money into court for an additional 30, 60, 90 days because it is administratively adjourning a case without that adjournment being attributable to either party and therefore making it so the tenant becomes further in arrears without ever ordering it to pay some portion of that money in court. As Eric was saying, is the only mechanism to ensure that tenants do not fall too far behind and property owners know that there's at least some, if you will, pot at the end of the long litigation rainbow.
So based on what you just said and the timeline that you described, the arrears become insurmountable before the court could have ordered that deposit of money.
In many cases, yes.
That's why we don't see this very often.
That's correct.
Are we seeing it at all?
Not really.
So would this case that you've brought compel the recipients of right to counsel and the attorneys that are fulfilling the right to counsel from legal aid and other organizations that might be involved, would it compel them to speed up this process where they're determining whether or not somebody is actually entitled to right to counsel?
It's not legal aid's fault that this administrative adjournment is occurring. It's on the fault of the Office of Court Administration for implementing this administrative adjournment in the first place. We were recently interviewed by a news publication, a real estate news publication, and one of their initial questions to us was, well, can't the court advise all tenants of their right to counsel before that case appears in court in the first place? Why does there need to be an administrative adjournment in the first place?
So is there an answer to that question?
To answer the question, it's in the notice of petition. In other words, the notice of petition that the tenant receives when the case is commenced specifically informs them of their right to obtain counsel and the right to counsel in some instances. And to the extent the Office of Court Administration wants more specificity as to their right to counsel, the notice of petition will be the perfect place to have it. So when the tenant receives the petition which commences the proceeding, all of that information can be right there. There is absolutely no reason to administratively adjourn these cases 2-3 months down the line for something that could have been put in the petition in the first instance.
I do want to make a distinction because I do think that the term administrative adjournments obviously has been used a lot. It's actually a very important aspect of where the court has sort of diverged from Article 7 and where our petition focuses. Because we talked about the protective mechanism under 745, talked about how there's this administrative adjournment at the first time on. But the statute specifically states, at the first time on, at the request of either party, the court shall adjourn the trial. So what's happening now is that no one's requesting this adjournment. The court is basically, there's no judge granting the adjournment. A landlord's representative is not often there to hear an application for an adjournment. It's just sort of done as a matter of course. And that's important because the protective mechanism under 745 is specifically based upon a landlord can make that request for the deposit of use and occupancy into court.
And that's 745.
745, Section 2. A landlord can specifically make that application upon the second of the adjournments requested by a tenant, so an attributable request but for an adjournment by a tenant, or for 60 days after the first time you've appeared in court, less any days that a landlord has requested for the adjournment. And what the right to counsel program did was it added another nuance to that, that also a respondent or a tenant's request to find counsel is also not counted in that time period, whether it be the two requests for an adjournment or the 60 days. No one's here saying that the court doesn't have discretion to grant adjournments, because certainly on both sides, there are legitimate reasons why people have to delay trial, whether it be to gather documents, to get witnesses, whatever the case may be. By not attributing it to either party, the protective mechanism 745-2 just never is triggered, because there's adjournment after adjournment granted, but no one can point to, well, that was the third adjournment request by a respondent, or it's been 60 days of attributable adjournments by the respondent, because when the court adjourns it without an application, there is no attribution of the adjournment. No, neither landlord nor the tenant are apparently responsible for that adjournment.
Well, we've certainly spent some time here identifying the challenges of a already difficult system that's become more difficult. What happens now? You've filed a petition, you have an index number, and when I say what happens now is what's the next thing that happens, and then what are the different possibilities after that?
So certainly what I expect to happen now is there's going to be communication by the corporate counsel and most likely by the Attorney General of the State of New York. And I'm pretty certain that they're going to request what's known as a briefing schedule, so that everyone has a specific timeline to for them to file an opposition to the petition and then us to file a reply there too. Certainly there can be a motion to dismiss made. I don't necessarily expect that to be a meritorious one.
And what part of the court is this filed in?
This is filed in the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court of New York?
Yes, correct. Not the United States Supreme Court. We're not there yet.
Could it eventually go there?
I suppose never say never. But that wouldn't necessarily serve our purposes anyway, because while we're filing this in the Supreme Court, we're plenary actions or actions seeking money or injunctive relief is usually sought.
So there's no seeking of money here or some kind of financial relief. This is just to get the court to operate the way it was supposed to in the first place?
Exactly. Just follow the law. That's the only thing that our client wants, and I think that's the only thing that a lot of the property owners in this city want.
And you say that this initial period of time is going to happen, and then beyond that, there could be a request for a dismissal, but you don't anticipate that. So then what happens? Is there a settlement? Do people agree to not go forward and have a trial? Or will there be a trial?
Well, we didn't say that there wouldn't be a motion to dismiss. What we said was we didn't think there would be a meritorious motion to dismiss. In all likelihood, there probably will be some type of motion seeking to dismiss the proceeding on some procedural ground. I think we've laid out in an extremely comprehensive complaint the proper predicates for the granting of the relief sought. I don't think this is something in which a settlement can happen because it's really not within our power or the Office of Court Administration's power to settle. We can't say that the statute requires that a trial be put on 3 to 8 days after the answer is interposed, but let's agree on 15 days among ourselves. You either have to comport with the statute or you're just not. And so long as the statute exists in its current form, the Office of Court Administration is obligated to adhere to it. If the Office of Court Administration believes that the statute should be amended, that's an issue to be taken up with the legislature. But it's not a matter of can we decide among ourselves what the proper time periods should be. That is a function of the legislature. The legislature so decided, the court needs to adhere to it.
So an Article 78 proceeding is not like a typical trial. Explain that to me.
So in an Article 78 proceeding, there is no witnesses. There is no trial per se. Article 78 proceedings are somewhat of an odd bird in terms of proceedings that can be brought in the Supreme Court. Obviously, as I said, you're not seeking money. You're not seeking injunctive relief. Basically, when you're preparing the pleading, unlike a summons and complaint in a plenary proceeding, which is something that can be amended, that you can conform it to proof later on, an Article 78 proceeding is brought with a petition that's both a pleading and basically a motion for summary judgment. You're not only stating, this is what I want, but this is what I deserve, and this is why I deserve it. And certainly respondents will make a motion to dismiss, which, as Nativ mentioned, we do expect, but and I certainly can probably guess what the bases are going to be. But eventually, we hope that the state and the city are going to have to come up with explanations, justifications for why the court system is plainly not operating as Article 7 envisioned, and then we'll have an opportunity to address that opposition.
And who makes the final determination? A judge?
A judge.
Can the defendants appeal?
The defendants can appeal because the Supreme Court is the lowest of courts within the plenary type of case. It's with Supreme Court, then there's an automatic right to appeal to the appellate division, and then a possible appeal to the Court of Appeals. It should also be mentioned that this specific case was brought in Queens County, so it's a Queens County Supreme Court justice who will be determining this particular petition. We do anticipate that similar lawsuits will be brought in both Kings County and New York County in the not-too-distant future. A number of landlords have reached out to us since we've commenced this petition and are asking if not only can they support it, but bring similar types of relief in King's Court and New York Court, because since this is a Queens County action, whatever determination is ultimately rendered by the Queens Court judge, it's not binding on any New York County judge or King's County judge or Bronx County judge for that matter. We do think it is important that similar petitions be brought in those counties. And to the extent there's any disparity in determinations, then the appellate division will ultimately run their ruling settling this matter.
So wait a minute. You said it was brought in Queens County. So does that mean if the judge rules in your favor in Queens County, that that's just for Queens County?
So a Queens County justice determination, while it may be persuasive authority, is not binding authority on any jurisdiction outside of Queens County. The only way it could be binding is if the Queens County determination is ultimately appealed. If it was appealed, it would go to the appellate division second department. And if there has never been a determination by any of the appellate divisions as to this issue, of which there has been none, then that issue will be binding on that determination will be binding upon counties even outside its jurisdiction until the appellate division of that jurisdiction renders a ruling.
It's important to keep in mind who's named in this lawsuit, because notwithstanding the jurisdictional issues of bringing this case in Queens County, it's important to keep in mind what the nature of the relief that we're seeking is, which is these writs of mandamus. It's a compulsion to follow the law and a prohibition to not act outside your jurisdiction. And the defendants in this lawsuit are not limited to Queens actors. We're talking about the Office of Court Administration, the Chief Administrator. So I think the OCA or Office of Court Administration, the Chief Administrator or the Chief Administrative Judge of the Civil Court, I think they'd be hard pressed to argue that notwithstanding a Queens court ruling that they are compelled to put in procedures to comply with law or compelled to stop acting outside of their jurisdiction with respect to what's defined in RPAPL Article 7, I think they'd be very hard-pressed to argue that that's limited to what they do in Queens, because it would be very strange for there to be a different procedure in Queens County Court than there would be across the civil court of New York City. But to go off of what Nativ did say, it's not only important to bring these cases in other counties because of the jurisdictional issues, but also to have the court, have the Office of Court Administration, have all of the respondents, relevant respondents to specific counties or the ones that will be included in any case, to have them explain what has happened. Give some sort of justification, because I think that's the first step in crafting a remedy that's going to fix the system. And so the more cases there are, the more OCA, the more the respondents are going to have to come up with a believable justification. And I think that will be the roadmap to how we fix it.
How long is this all going to take? Have you anticipated that?
I think it's an old adage that the wheels of justice turn very slowly, often slower than a lot of litigators would like. The hope is certainly that within the next 3 to 6 months, everything is fully briefed, perhaps oral argument happens, and then it depends what kind of decision is going to be rendered, because if it's a simple one, then obviously it doesn't take as long. But I think we hope that it's a detailed and well-reasoned decision that does craft a roadmap forward.
We get all the briefs in within 3 to 6 months, the likelihood is that we'll see a resolution of this matter, at least initially, at the trial court level, most likely between 9 and 12 months.
So the fact that this has been filed and now it's out there, do you think that will motivate anybody in the administrative agencies to change things internally proactively?
I don't think so. I think that if they were to do so, they would be almost admitting the fact that they haven't been acting in accordance with the statute, which would be detrimental to their case. I think it's the right thing to do. I think we've very clearly set forth in this comprehensive petition a number of steps and mechanisms in which they're failing to comply with the statute. And I think anyone who's reading it, a fair reading of the statute, will look at it from the offices of OCA and say, clearly, we're not adhering to the statute, but if you're asking me from a realistic perspective, do we expect that to happen? I don't anticipate that.
I wouldn't expect them to change how things are being done before trying to put forth the two defenses that are certainly going to come in response to this petition. One in which that there is precedent that courts have this sort of general inherent authority to control their calendars. But when you talk about a very specific mandate by statute, I think they're going to have a very hard time talking about this general authority trumping very explicit time limitations and very explicit directives in RPAPL Article 7. And then certainly when you're talking about the chief administrator in OCA, you're talking about a very general constitutional authority that the chief administrator is clothed with in order to regulate a procedure for the administration of justice in the courts. But when you read this petition and you see how far we've come away from the expedient, the efficient delivery of justice in summary proceedings, I think they're going to have a hard time using that sort of general constitutional authority to justify where we've come. So, in answer to your question, I don't expect them receiving this petition in the first instance to change anything. But if those defenses are rebuked, as I certainly hope and expect they will be, I think that it will be a moment of realization that things aren't working right and that something has to be done.
So I've never seen anything like this before. Is this the first time that something like this has been done?
Actually, there's a rather similar lawsuit that was filed back in the 80s. The name of the case was Brusco versus Braun. Shout out to Nick Brusco and family. What happened there was that, again, the statute requires that if a tenant defaults in the proceeding, a landlord shall be entitled to a warrant. And as has happened in this case with warrants, where now judges are setting forth discretionary tactics and asking for ancillary items in addition to the information that is to be put forth in obtaining the warrant. In that case, what certain judges were doing, in that case, it was Judge Braun, they said, no, you're not going to get a warrant just because a tenant defaulted as set forth in the statute, but instead, what we're going to do is compel the landlord to prove his case by way of what's known as an inquest. And so Nick Brusco commenced the case against OCA and the judges, saying, you don't have the authority to do that. You have to follow the statute. And it went all the way up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals ruled in Brusco's favor, which is to say that they said, no, the courts are obligated to guide themselves according to the language of the statute. And so we're hoping for a similar result in this instance.
Well, it set a precedent for your case. Is that true?
Yes.
But we are 40 years from that, and however many administrations and changes.
And perspectives.
Exactly.
Yeah, perspectives are much different.
I encourage everyone to read the petition. A lot of time and effort was spent in crafting the petition, and hopefully when one reads it, I'm not saying it's a page-turner, but I think when you go through it, you'll see how comprehensive and I believe persuasive it is that the court system has gone awry. And I think it's a worthy read and something that every landlord in the city, as well as tenants, should be looking at and seeing how we can correct this proceeding. It should be noted, we've had discussions with tenants' attorneys as well. And tenants' attorneys have also told us, I'm glad you brought this lawsuit so we can correct the housing court as it currently exists, we asked them, do you want to put your name to that and support it? And of course, they said no, but they have told us in informal discussions that they see great benefit in this lawsuit to the extent that it ultimately corrects the housing court as it exists.
What do you think the economic implications of this is up to this point with the way things are going, and what the economic economic implications would be, assuming you were ruled in your favor?
Well, as we spoke about before, the economic implications are, if housing court is ultimately run efficiently and effectively as it's intended, then these disputes can be resolved. Landlords have the means upon which to operate their building. Tenants have the means upon which to pay their arrears, whether through their own efforts or through government assistance. And it furthers the functioning of not only housing court, but residential real estate in the city in general. If it's not resolved in our favor, such that OCA is under the impression that they can continue to add even further, perhaps, administration impediments that further delays housing court disputes, then I think landlords just completely turn away from housing court and just start plenary actions, which will just simply overload Supreme Court, the Supreme Court calendars. And I think they would have just given up on housing court in general, which will not only cause the demise of housing court, but will further the ever-quickening demise of the residential real estate theater in general.
Guys, this has been very, very informative. I'm sure the Realty Speak audience are thrilled, and I'm sure the three property owner organizations here in the city of New York, many of you know who they are: CHIP, Community Housing Improvement Program, RSA, Rent Stabilization Association, and SPONY, the Small Property Owners of New York, are very, very excited that this petition has been filed and that you're moving forward with this case. Thanks so much for being here. How can people get in touch with you should they want to talk to you about this or some other legal real estate matter? Latif?
So they can go on our website, cookamarino.com. You have all of our contact information, our email addresses, and any support that the public can provide in relation to these petitions or otherwise will certainly be welcomed.
And Realty Speak listeners, I'm going to put the contact information for each Nativ, Craig, and Eric in the show notes. There is a question I want to ask of all of you before we sign off for the day. If you woke up tomorrow and something in the world had changed, what do you wish it would be?
Let me limit my response to probably what interests the listeners of this podcast, which is the real estate world. And I think that everyone listening, fair-minded person listening, we can all agree that HESPA was a disaster for the New York real estate community. When I say HESPA, I mean the Housing Stability Tenant Protection Act of 2019. And so if I was to wake up tomorrow and know that some of the amendments which have just crushed the real estate industry would be amended. And I should add that there are some legislative bills that are currently being discussed today. I know CHIP has sponsored something speaking about where they can get vacancy increases on a unit in which a tenant has been in possession for over 10 years. Things of that nature, which will allow landlords to recoup some of the monies that are needed to be put into these apartments so you don't have these vacant apartments, which you only have because landlords are unable to recoup their investments. Things like that will revitalize the real estate industry. It is imperative that some of the various amendments that were put in place by virtue of HESPA be corrected, not necessarily so a landlord can profit, but so that a landlord can administer his building in a proper way and still be able to operate it such that it inures to the benefit of everyone concerned: landlord, tenants, citizens of New York. So that's what I would wish if I could wake up tomorrow and knowing that the certain aspects of HESPA were revised so we can look at the long-term solutions instead of just short-term votes.
If I woke up tomorrow and politicians stopped politicizing real estate, that would be a very welcome change in our world.
Eric?
Something that actually applies to the petition that we brought, but even sort of the general practice of law in this great city, in this great state. Unfortunately, the wheels of justice do tend to turn very slowly. If I did have a wish that would be granted tomorrow, it would be that justice would be as swift as was imagined by the legislature.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for being here to discuss this topic with me and the Realty Speak listeners.
Thank you, Bill. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us, Bill.
Thanks very much for having us, Bill. I hope this is the first of many opportunities I have to speak with you.
Well, there you have it, everyone. Thank you for listening. I look forward to you joining me for the next episode of Realty Speak, the podcast. Please subscribe. Search for Realty Speak on your favorite podcast app like Podcast Republic, My Fave on Android, or Apple Podcasts for an iPhone. Find it, open it, hit subscribe, and you're in. Spotify? Yes, you'll find Realty Speak there as well. And don't forget to check out the show notes for information and links. Please help Realty Speak grow by sharing the show with others. How? Do an email blast. Include as part of your newsletter or on your website blog. Post from your LinkedIn, Facebook, and/or X profiles. And of course, if you'd like to talk about purchasing, selling, financing investment real estate, having a New York City Local Law 152 gas piping inspection done, access past episodes, or just chat, you can contact me directly via the website at billweidner.com. That's BILLWEIDNER.com. And remember, it's not about us, but how we help you make the bottom line rise. Until next time.